Advertising your business with GCN is simple, effective,
and more affordable than you might think.
Visit advertise.gcnlive.com for more info. Take your business to the next level.
Paracast, the gold standard of paranormal radio. And now, here's Gene Steinberg.
Graham Rendell is with us on this episode of the Paracast. And as you know, I follow a lot of the early flying saucer stuff. And one of the reasons is that nobody else is following it. We have the Pentagon here in the U.S., which is looking at military sightings, but doesn't care a whit about what the military was doing back in 1947, thereabouts. But Graham Rendell has written a book called Dawn of the Flying Saucers, Aerial UFO Encounters and Official Investigations, 1946 to 1949. And I would say those are probably, what would you say, Graham, the golden years of the UFO mystery?
In the formative years, yes. I mean, you know, this is where it all kicked off, or at least in terms of the modern-day phenomenon. So, yes, it's an extremely important time.
Did you follow much how we handled it here in the States or worldwide or what?
I mean, the book basically concentrates a lot on America because that's where most of the information comes from in terms of that period. But there were other things happening elsewhere. So it's good to be able to sort of switch the book away at times from what was happening in the States because it was effectively a worldwide phenomenon and continues to be today.
Now, what got you started in chasing flying saucers?
I'm 56 years old now, so I go back to about the age of 8 or 9, and I was really interested in science fiction. I was reading the likes of Isaac Asimov, E. Van Vogt, E. Doc Smith, those kind of books. My mother, bless her, she bought me another book, thinking it was another one of these types of books I was reading, because it had a picture of a spacecraft on the front, except it wasn't fiction, it was non-fiction. It was a book called Mysterious Visitors by Brinsley LePoet Trench, who was a UFO author from the 60s and the 70s, and it was about UFOs. Being a kind of curious kid as I was then, it just got me hooked, and my brain exploded, if you like, and it just went from there, basically.
Well, Brinsley LePoet Trench was also one of the pioneers in writing books about ancient astronauts well before Erich von Däniken got into that.
Oh, yes, that's right, yes. He certainly had some interesting theories back then. It was just enough to stimulate my interest, and I moved away from that kind of thing into the more, I suppose, nuts and bolts in terms of the much more the modern encounters rather than the biblical encounters and the ancient astronauts kind of thing. I moved on to different books. I moved on to John Keel. I moved on to other Tim Goode and some other people in the 1970s and 1980s and further on. So, yeah, I broadened my horizons, I guess.
Well, certainly you broaden your horizons if you read John Keel. And I only regret that he was rather crusty in his old age. And we tried to get him on the Paracast, and I didn't make the call. We fell named Tim Beckley, don't know if you know him. He, no longer with us, by the way, He gave the phone number to an original co-host here. The co-host called Keel. Keel says, "How did you get my number?" Clunk, hung up.
I can imagine that's how the phone conversation went. Oh, bless him.
It was so interesting because when I knew him, I had just moved back to New York. And I called Keel and said, "Hey, I'm in your neighborhood. Can I drop over a few minutes?" And we spent like 4 or 5 hours chatting at his apartment. He was really a great guy, very funny. But as he got older, as many of us are wont to do, because you're just a young whippersnapper compared to us, it was rather different. Now, as I was considering your book, I was looking here at the very first issue of Fate magazine, not the one printed in 1948, but the reprint that Phyllis Galdi did. And this is available, by the way, you can buy this. And the first article in that magazine is one that we could get into because it's considered the progenitor of modern flying saucers, The Truth About the Flying Saucers by Kenneth Arnold.
Yeah. Kenneth Arnold, I mean, he is effectively right there at the start. He's not actually the one who sees one of these objects for the first time. There were obviously lots of people beforehand, in 47, also 46, and even earlier than that. But he's the one that everybody seems to latch onto, because when he lands and after he tells his story, it just seems to snowball, doesn't it? You know, the newspaper reporting, it just seems to be the right time, the right place, where everybody wants to have a piece of this story and they want to publicize it. And then do you get copycats, or do you get people who come along afterwards and have their own sightings? But it just sort of mushrooms into this huge phenomenon. And of course, he's the person that people want to talk to. He's the people that want to read about. And he's the person that people want to learn more about his sighting.
It was interesting that Ray Palmer latched on to Arnold in the early days when he was the co-publisher of Fate magazine and got him to write that, but also when the Maury Island incident occurred, he hoodwinked, and I'll say that, hoodwinked, he hoodwinked Arnold into participating in that. Now, in terms of Arnold's sighting, what do you think was the most compelling thing about it that caused it to basically generate a worldwide phenomenon? Because, as you say, things were seen before then.
I think it was probably just the fact that he was who he was. He was a self-employed businessman. He was fairly well respected in his neighbourhood. He wasn't probably somebody who was going to come along and tell a wild story. He'd already done a little bit of homework to try and work out what they were with some of his colleagues at the airport that he landed at after he'd seen these nine objects. So he wasn't somebody who was necessarily looking for fame and fortune. I mean, I think he probably regretted everything that he got into because of all the hassle he had to endure, because it got in the way of his business afterwards, because he would turn up somewhere and he would have flocks of newspaper reporters, you know, sort of at him for 5 minutes of his time everywhere he went. So it was probably a bit of a millstone after a while. But I think it was literally just that time, and maybe it was, you know, I don't know whether it was a slow news day or was because of that flying saucer kind of image that was portrayed by the journalist that basically coined that phrase. But it seemed to, you know, strike a chord, and it just went right across America, and obviously people may be having their own sightings at the time for whatever reason why it kicked off then in such big numbers. But it seemed to, you know, be one of those things that set a trend off, and newspapers, bear in mind, I suppose the press are always hungry to latch onto a story that's going to have legs, if you like. It just seemed to have, you know, a lot of mileage in it. And people were coming along all the time saying, yes, I've seen one of these as well. But they weren't necessarily the same thing. They were all different shapes and sizes. The sightings had different sort of, you know, bits to them. So it wasn't just somebody seeing the same thing again and again and again. So there was a lot of information, and there was a lot of interest in the story, but a lot of facets to it as well. So that's what made it so enduring. It wasn't just one of these, you know, here today, gone tomorrow phenomenon. It had a lot of legs to it.
Now, one of the linchpins of the Arnold sighting was the speed at which he estimated the craft. If it wasn't so fast, they might have thought, maybe that's something conventional. But as soon as you had the speed estimate, oh no, we can't do that.
That's right. I mean, if it had been a lot closer to him and he could have identified what they were, like a flock of geese, or it was a flight of aircraft, then obviously the story would never have gone anywhere. But the fact that they were so far away, but he could still, you know, make out kind of sort of details of them in terms of they were shiny and they were heel shaped, because that was the shape that he drew. It wasn't that crescent kind of that came along later on. But also, as you say, the speed, he had to actually dial down the speed. He'd originally estimated something, I think, like 1,800 miles an hour, but then it dialed it back down to about 1,300. But at the time, that was at least twice the speed of the fastest jet in 1947. It was certainly a lot faster than any of the propeller-driven fighters at that time. So, you know, it was something that when the press got a hold of that information, then, you know, that was something, well, how can this be? Because they're just going so fast. And that obviously was something else that just added to the mystery.
What made it more difficult for the skeptics to say something about it? This is going to be a real fascinating episode. We're going back to the beginning, dawn of the flying saucers, aerial UFO encounters and official investigations, 1946 to 1949. Graham Rendell apparently has made a lot of effort into exploring the early sightings, and maybe as we progress, we could see what we can learn from them. I think part of the problem currently in UFO research is that we haven't learned anything, and we ignore the lessons of history, and therefore we are, to quote the cliche, doomed to repeat it. Graham, Gene, and Tim, you're in
the Paracast.
Hey, listeners. I want you to have the entire Paracast experience. So I'd like to tell you about After the Paracast. After the Paracast is an exclusive feature for subscribers to the Paracast Plus. With After the Paracast, you never know what's going to happen next. After the Paracast features color commentary, special interviews, and further conversations with Paracast guests. With Paracast Plus, you can download a very special enhanced version of the Paracast also. We do offer exclusive music, videos, and more features are coming. To get more info about subscribing, please visit theparacast.plus. Once again, theparacast.plus. Prices are just $1.50 a week, less than a cup of coffee at your local convenience store. Check out theparacast.plus to learn more about Paracast Plus.
First, we decide where we want to go. Then we need to know the best way to get there. Hi, my name's Adam Baratta. I'm the owner of Advantage Gold. We're the highest rated precious metals firm in the country. We teach people how to own physical gold and silver. Now, we've won the Best of TrustLink Award 4 years in a row because we educate our clients on how to buy gold and silver the right way. We don't pay celebrity spokespeople millions of dollars. We'd rather pass that value on to you. Call 800-900-8000 and speak with one of our experts. We'll send you a free gold kit along with my latest number one national best-selling book, The Great Devaluation. Call 800-900-8000. That's 800-900-8000. Get the best information, the best process, the best service, the best value. Call Advantage Gold at 800-900-8000. Call 800-900-8000.
Advantage Gold is not an investment advisor or a tax advisor. Consult with your financial advisor before investing.
Call 800-900-8000.
When I was a kid, I wanted to be just like Cal Ripken. It's definitely humbling to know that now people are calling me a hero. Instead of finding the IED with my metal detector, the IED found me first, and that resulted in double above-knee amputations. It's hard to describe the feeling of meeting somebody that you've always wanted to be like. There are people now that are looking up to you for their inspiration and to be their role model.
Visit saluteheroes.org to learn more.
Hi, this is Sophie Winnick, longtime distributor and user of Longevity products. In the last few years, my family went through a crisis. Everything else in my life, including my business, had to be put on the back burner. Thankfully, life is getting back to normal now. But the one thing I never had to worry about was my business and my monthly commission. I've been a distributor for Longevity for over 17 years, since before it was Longevity. And I've got to say, the most amazing thing about this company is the people. While my family was in crisis, other distributors stepped in and helped my customers, simply because that's what Longevity people do, even for people they don't know. For me, it has never been about getting rich. It was about a product I could stand behind, a company I could count on, and a monthly commission check that has never, not once, been late in 17 years. Longevity is truly a business for everyone, even people who have too much to do. I'm Sophie Winnick. I'm just like you. I have a real life, real ups and downs, but I know I will always have Longevity.
Hi, I'm Dan Pilla. I started fighting the IRS over 40 years ago when they tried to seize my mother's house. I sued the IRS and won. I beat the IRS then, and I've been beating them ever since. I wrote the book on tax debt settlement, and I've helped thousands of people deal with tax problems they thought might never be solved. I can help you too. If you owe taxes you can't pay, don't wait another day. There's no such thing as a hopeless tax case. Call 800-34-NO-TAX or go to my website, danpilla.com. That's danpilla.com, danpilla.com.
We'd like to hear from you. If you have a comment or question about the Paracast, send it to news@theparacast.com. That's news@theparacast.com. And don't forget to visit our famous Paracast community forums at forum.theparacast.com.
Graham Rendell, talking about the early days of flying saucers. We're focusing here on the Kenneth Arnold sighting and the factors such as speed that made it impossible to identify. But just to jump over to the other case, he investigated Maury Island. What's your take on that?
Wasn't it coal? Wasn't it some kind of slag from a local kind of industrial process? I mean, I've never really delved that deeply into that particular case beyond what I know of it from just a brief look in terms of what information I used for the book. Because from people who I've spoke to who know much more about that case, it seems quite convoluted. It's apparently hoaxed. And that there are a lot of people that contradict themselves when they tell the story. It just seemed a bit of a mess from all accounts. But, as you mentioned before, Ray Palmer, he basically gave or offered Kenneth Arnold some money to go and investigate it for him. Kenneth Arnold said, yes, okay, he'll do it. And for whatever reason, he decided that he would agree. And when he came away from it, he also enlisted the help of Emil Smith, who was a United Airlines pilot, who also had his own sighting. But the two of them basically came up with nothing. I'm not sure whether you have anything to the contrary of that, but to my mind, it was some kind of slag that fell from the sky, or it might have been ejected from some kind of process. But it was certainly whatever it was, it wasn't what they were saying it was.
Well, you know, there was a flame war between Ray Palmer and Captain Ruppelt, who wrote the book, The Report on Unidentified Flying Objects. He was one of the early heads of Project Blue Book.
Yeah.
And he called it one of the worst hoaxes ever. And he identified Palmer as, quote, unquote, Chicago publisher. Palmer said, whatever it is, I didn't invent it. And I can't imagine that he found a way to have slag fall in the harbor and cause this. But what bothered me so much about the case, and as you say, you haven't really spent a lot of time with it, is when Kenneth Arnold comes into, I guess, Tacoma, and he tries to find a room. And they tell him none are available. And suddenly he finds this hotel where not only do they have the room, it was already registered or at least reserved in his name. That's issue number one, which is crazy. The second one is they're feeling, him and Captain Smith, that there was some eavesdropping going on. So I just wonder how intelligence seemed to get involved.
I think the third part of this, which makes it maybe why people still think there's something to it, is that when the two Air Force officers had that piece and they were going to take it back for analysis, and of course the aircraft crashed, didn't it, and they were both killed. I think that's another part of it which just thinks, people come along and think, well, was there something to it? Were those two counterintelligence corps officers, when they were flying back to California with that piece that they were going to investigate, was it a case of, was there some kind of sabotage to stop an investigation going on? I mean, those are questions that people have asked before, but aircraft do crash. It could simply have been coincidence. I've never really thought that story actually had any kind of substance to it beyond, what some people have said in the past. But quite frankly, it just seems to be a string of coincidences and a couple of people maybe, or somebody who's told tall tales. And then, of course, when they tried to find one of them, didn't he disappear or something and ended up in Alaska? I think I might be getting the story wrong. But it was definitely one of the people involved in it. Was it Fred Chrisman? Didn't he go missing or something?
Fred Lee Chrisman's another story. I want to hit that in a moment. But, there was another incident which Arnold cited in the book, The Coming of the Saucers, that he co-wrote with Palmer, and I assume Palmer did heavy editing on it. But he points to an instance where he takes off in his plane, and suddenly the engine shuts itself off, and he nearly crashes. Now, one could say, well, maybe he accidentally turned the engine off, but this is an experienced private pilot, and that's a pretty damn stupid thing to do. Okay, that's one thing. Now we have one of the harbor patrolmen, Fred Chrisman, who has a really, really, really weird background, one of which he was one of the characters that New Orleans DA Jim Garrison was looking into when he was investigating the Kennedy assassination. Later on, he did a right-wing talk show, I think, in the Seattle area. I, in fact, had a friend, he's no longer with us, a guy named Floyd Murray, who was actually researching Chrisman's background, but he never really came up with any conclusions, or if he did, he was long gone. Just wanted to give you that background.
I think the other thing I found out about him that I thought was something interesting to put in the book was the fact that he reckoned he'd been a World War II fighter pilot, but also he'd sent letters to Palmer's magazine saying that fighting with underground entities in a Burmese cave during the war. So It was, you know, not sure kind of how much his head was screwed on properly kind of thing. So it was all a bit, it just left me a bit sort of cold when I read about it, thinking, well, okay, how is this guy playing with a full deck kind of thing? So, yeah, a lot of it just didn't add up for me, I'm afraid.
Well, in the case of those letters, this is when, of course, Palmer was pushing the Shaver mystery.
Yeah. Which they didn't add up to anything either, did they?
It's weird. I knew Palmer very, very slightly. I knew Shaver more than slightly because we corresponded with him, my first wife and I, for a number of years. We met him in the early 1970s, a few years before he died. We interviewed him, and I think it's probably the only interview that Richard Shaver ever gave, other than maybe doing a couple of talk shows with Palmer. But it's just very interesting about it because he seemed like such a nice, easygoing guy with a very subtle sense of humor. And I think towards the end of the interview, for example, he says, I said, well, anything else to say? And he said, yeah, I have to go get a cigarette.
I've got a friend who's delved into the Shaver mysteries, and he the last time I asked him about it, he just shook his head basically and went, "We'll not bother so talking about it." And he's somebody I respect. He's a member of UAP Media UK and somebody who's delved into these kind of things, and I respect his opinion. So, Dave Partridge, if you're out there at the end, yes, I'll go with what you say.
That's fair enough, I think. Because I don't know what happened to Shaver. There are other things I'd like to talk about, but this is not a Shaver show. We've done that already. I want to get back into the early cases. Looking at the cases that you chose from 1946 to 1949, what do you think was the most compelling? If you were saying, this is the sighting you got to look at if you're trying to understand the early days of the modern phenomenon.
Well, I mean, people look at the Mantell case because, you know, it's got the death of the pilot, but I think I would skip forward to the 1st of October 1948 and George Gorman, who was a first lieutenant with the North Dakota Air National Guard. And he was based at Fargo, North Dakota, and he was coming back from a routine exercise flight one night with three of his colleagues. And he still had fuel left in his tanks. So the other three aircraft landed. He decided to fly around in the circuit for a bit above the airfield. And he looks down and he sees this Piper Cub flying into the airport. But then he also sees this light below him. And then, of course, it becomes effectively a dogfight between him and this strange light. And the light's making a head-on passes at him. And the first time when it comes at him, he basically dives out of the way of it because he's frightened it's going to hit him.
We'll pause the pause that refreshes. No, that's a cliche. Graham, Gene, and Tim, you're in.
The Paracast.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Visit GCNlive.com today.
Do you need to get your hands on some extra money right now? Maybe $25,000 or more? If you're a homeowner, now is a perfect time to get cash out while homes in many neighborhoods like yours have gone up in value. You can use the money for anything. It's yours. You can buy an investment property, pay off higher interest debt, or make home improvements. If you need $25,000, $50,000, or more, now is the time. Home values are up, and so is your equity. We offer you a way to use it. No need to use your savings. Call New American Funding now and see how much cash out you can get. Call 800-721-2477. 800-721-2477. 800-721-2477. That's 800-721-2477. NMLS 6606. www.nmlsconsumeraccess.org. This is not an offer or commitment to lend. Subject to borrower and property qualifications. Not all borrowers will qualify. Terms and conditions apply. Equal housing opportunity.
USA News Update. In the wake of the Tyre Nichols beating video, Memphis police are disbanding the Scorpion unit. The five officers fired and charged in connection with the death of Nichols were part of that unit. Two people are injured in a shooting in Jerusalem just a day after a gunman killed at least seven people near a synagogue. The pair injured are a father and son, with the suspect being a 13-year-old. Police say the teenager was neutralized and injured by passersby who carried licensed weapons. Utah is banning gender-affirming care for minors. On Saturday, Republican Governor Spencer Cox signed a bill that disallows access to hormonal treatments and surgical procedures for anyone under 18. Former President Trump was making campaign stops in two states on Saturday, the keynote address to Republican leaders in New Hampshire and South Carolina for his first official 2024 event. Jerry Barmash, USA News.
If you're concerned about the power grid and want to generate your own supply of off-grid electricity, this will be the most important message you'll hear this year. Here's why. We now have a small number of solar generators back in stock. These emergency backup systems provide life-saving backup power when you need it most. And unlike gas generators, solar generators run quietly, emit no dangerous fumes, and produce an endless supply of free electricity from the sun. Whether it's wildfires, dangerous weather, power grid issues, or just getting off the grid, you'll never have to suffer through painful power outages again. Even better, all this week, radio listeners get over $700 in free off-the-grid bonuses, too. Go to MySolarBackup.com to learn more and check availability. That's MySolarBackup.com. Look for the free report, Crisis Cooling, how to make absolutely sure your meat, milk, and medicines stay safe and cool in any power outage. Yours free at MySolarBackup.com.
Get healthy, not high, with 100% pure CBD powerful natural pain relief from Veterans Vitality. GCN listeners, have you ever thought about how CBD may help you? I'm sure you have heard about the many benefits of CBD. Well, here's your opportunity to try before you buy. Created by veterans and for everyone who deserves better choices, our CBD is derived from organic hemp, grown in the USA, and third-party tested. Veterans Vitality CBD saves you as much as 25 to 50% over our competition, and a portion of all sales is contributed to veteran nonprofits and events. Many of our customers have experienced improved quality of life, help with anxiety, PTSD, and overall well-being. Our products do not contain THC. They are safe, non-addictive, effective, and 100% legal. GCN listeners, get your free trial bottle of premium CBD by simply paying shipping and handling at GCNFreeCBD.com. That's GCNFreeCBD.com. Again, GCNFreeCBD.com. Offered by Veterans Vitality Premium CBD.
This is Jacques Vallée. You're listening to the Paracast, the gold standard of paranormal radio.
We're talking about the Gorman case, is it, Graham? And the first part we left in the previous segment, let's continue.
Yeah, so he's got this light coming at him. The first time he dives out the way and it goes straight at level flight beyond him. And then it comes round again and it's making it a second head-on pass at him. So he decides this time, I'm not going to chicken out. He keeps the aircraft straight and level. He's flying in an F-51 Mustang, by the way. So it's a propeller-driven World War II era aircraft. And it flies straight over, it climbs up in front of him and straight upwards almost. And he goes after it. But because it's flying upwards so quickly, he can't keep up with it. And in fact, he basically runs out of air. The engine, he gets into what he calls an engine stall, which means the engine can't basically propel him upwards any longer. And he falls out of the sky. And he manages to regain control, and it comes down for a third go at him. So it's effectively toying with him, it's playing with him, this light. And he never gets any kind of identification, but the fact that it's just a light. And then it disappears. Now, this is actually in the vicinity of an airport over a city in North Dakota. It's not in the middle of nowhere. It's not near, it's not over the desert or anything like that. So it's in a strange place for, say, another aircraft from maybe another squadron or from another unit to play, in a really highly dangerous area. And Gorman's really shaken. He's obviously shocked about the fact that something has either trying to knock him out of the sky, or it's toying with him when really that shouldn't happen. And of course, the Blue Book, Project Sign, when they looked at it, and they tried to do an investigation, and they worked out that there'd been a balloon had been released from the airport, a weather balloon. But the weather balloons at that time were black. They weren't white or the kind of like translucent colour. So he wouldn't have seen it. And then they try to say, oh, well, you're looking at stars, but actually the light to start with was below him. So there was a lot of information regarding this case which didn't add up. not in a bad way, just didn't add, it actually added up to a mystery. And it's really compelling because the fact that it's not just somebody seeing a light in the sky that moves or seeing a kind of object that they can't work out. It's the fact that it actually interacts with him to a certain degree and the fact that there's an element of danger involved as well. But thankfully, in this case, rather than the Mantell case, he actually manages to survive and he walks away from the incident. And they checked the aircraft out, they checked the instruments out, he was obviously interrogated, you know, they did all the investigators did all their due diligence, but they couldn't find anything, bar the fact that they tried to write it off as a weather balloon. So it's one of those things that just becomes completely unexplained. They did try to actually say that it might have been a Canadian Air Force vampire jet, but why was a Canadian Air Force aircraft coming over the border? And the Canadian Air Force said, well, no, we have not any aircraft that did that. So it's a real, real mystery.
Well, it's interesting how you have these the skeptics who will try to come up with any kind of explanation except what the pilot actually experienced. That's just, oh, well, you know, that it just sounds too crazy, so obviously it didn't happen.
Yeah, well, that happens today as well. That's happened throughout, you know, from 1948 onwards. Every time a highly trained professional observer, like a pilot, has come along and said, look, I saw this, I saw that, there's always been an attempt to say, well, actually, you saw this instead. But if that's the case, why didn't they see these things all the time? Why weren't they, you know, why didn't the pilot come along and say, oh, yes, well, I've seen weather balloons. This wasn't that. This wasn't a weather balloon. And a lot of the times they're adamant that what the Blue Book and the Grudge and Tsai were saying these things were, they're totally adamant that, no, it wasn't. Because if it was, I would recognize what that was.
Oh, I remember seeing some well-known skeptic, I'm going to leave his name out of the conversation here, on television one time, just outright state that pilots are not good observers of what's going on around them. And it just, you know, and other people have said this as well, but you know, at the time it made me think, well, why are they pilots if they're not good observers? Especially military pilots.
You have something called situational awareness. They have to know what's around them. And a military pilot, especially a combat pilot, not only has to look at their instruments and also what's in front of them, but they have to almost know what's around them as well. So they're highly switched on in terms of what's happening in and around the airspace they're flying in. They get shot down really quickly. They wouldn't last 5 minutes in an engagement if they didn't have that awareness of what was happening. So, you know, and also to try and say that a highly trained pilot, even back in those days, you know, didn't know the difference between like a weather balloon or another aircraft and something that they couldn't identify, it's just, you know, it just leaves a bit of taste in the mouth, really. And I'm sure the pilots back then, when they found out that this is what was being said about what they saw, if they ever got the information, that is, I'm sure they wouldn't have been amused.
I think a lot of people don't realize just, and as you stated, how similar this situation was to the Mantell case, with the exception that this pilot managed to survive.
In terms of the Mantell case, I mean, obviously, there's a lot we don't know about that. We have the information from the two surviving pilots who were in the formation with him when they were chasing after whatever this thing was they were going after. But then also we have the voice communications from the tower at Godman Field, because they were in radio contact with the three aircraft. And also there's a little bit of kind of contradiction in terms of what the surviving pilots said about what their oxygen was like and how they were. And one of the pilots said he had problems with his oxygen at something like 12,000 feet. But then they said they went up to 20,000 feet before they turned back. Now, so there's some bits of that story that don't add up with the information that we're left with, and it's only a real shame. Not only is it a personal tragedy for the Mantell family, but also the fact that we can't speak to him, or we haven't had any kind of information from him to be able to try and find out what actually happened, to fill in the blanks for that case, because it's a really, you know, compelling story in so much as what they were following, because people had seen an object not just at Godman Field when the four aircraft were asked to go after this thing, but it'd been seen in other parts of Kentucky and also in Ohio the same day. So there was definitely something that was in and around that area that people were seeing and reporting, but it only was just the kind of coincidence that the tower at Godman Field in Kentucky had had seen it themselves at the time these four aircraft happened to be flying through their airspace, and they said, look, you have to go and investigate this. And obviously that led to the tragedy with Thomas Mantell.
Well, in both of these cases, though, you had the kind of official, I'll put quotation marks around that, official explanation that the pilots were chasing a weather balloon.
That's right, yes. In terms of Mantell, it was also Venus. That was also put forward as an explanation, and then that was rescinded. But the weather balloon story stuck. It was alleged by, or it was suggested by somebody who worked at, I think it was the University in Nashville, that they'd seen a weather balloon, but it was in the wrong place and the wrong time. And then Edward Ruppelt came along a lot later and said, well, it was probably a Skyhook balloon, and that was where the secret U.S. Navy project for putting instrument packages underneath the high-altitude research balloon. And they said that postulated that there'd been one of these things had been launched from, I believe it was somewhere across the border from Kentucky, just to the north, and it had drifted over that particular part of the airspace of southern Kentucky, and that's where it had been seen. But somebody who was some scientist or a professor who was actually engaged in this project had came along afterwards and said, well, actually, where Ruppelt said this balloon should have been launched from, they didn't even launch them in 1948. It was only much later, in much later years, when they actually used that particular site. So what Ruppelt was saying, or what he was suggesting, didn't add up either. So, there were various attempts to try and rubbish not just the Mantell case, but a lot of other cases back then. But it was they would find one particular part of a case and go, oh, well, we can explain that. But then, and that's how they would do it, and they would just write off the rest of it because they could possibly solve or suggest something that would fit one bit of it, but it didn't necessarily mean that the rest of the case, was solved, because a lot of it, the rest of it just didn't add up.
We're going to add this up and then get back with Graham Rendell to talk about the Vantage UFO sightings. With Gene and Tim, you're in
the Panicast.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Visit GCNlive.com today.
Do you need a website? Well, you can get a great deal on hosting services with Namecheap's legendary coupon code. They're offering substantial hosting discounts on shared hosting, business hosting, VPS hosting, reseller hosting, and even dedicated servers. Namecheap is preferred by millions. It's backed by a money-back guarantee. Use the coupon code LEGENDARY to cash in on the special deal at Namecheap.com, Namecheap.com.
First game Attack of the Rockoids, and it was a critically acclaimed success. And now there's The Coming of the Protectors. A former military intelligence man is contacted by a space woman in a dream. A dream that turns out to be a nightmare, because evil forces on our distant planet are planning to conquer the Earth. This is gripping science fiction of the classic kind. Attack of the Rockoids and The Coming of the Protectors. Find out more at Rockoids.com. That's Rockoids, Rockoids.com.
Frustrated trying to get business capital? Want to take the slow process and rejection out of the equation? GCNLoans.com removes the slow, irritating approval process. Instead, get quick, simple funding. Powered by David Allen Capital, 80% of our pre-qualified clients are approved in days. Pre-qualify at GCNLoans.com and get your money this week. It's that easy. GCNLoans.com. That's GCNLoans.com.
Silver has always been nature's very own antibiotic, and only one system allows you to generate an endless supply of natural silver solutions. SilverLungs.com. You'll find no wild claims or pseudoscience, just a lifetime of nano-sized pure silver solutions. The Silver Lungs generator allows you to make your own, so stop paying for silver solutions. The unique lung delivery system targets respiratory infections where other silver solutions simply cannot reach. See the Silver Lungs generator and lung delivery system at SilverLungs.com. That's SilverLungs.com.
I had no idea it would destroy my life. But before it happened, I had a successful business in Austin, Texas. Everyone laughed at me when I shut that business down, but I could not ignore the wake-up call. I was volunteering on a project to get locally grown food into a school. That project was a complete failure, and I discovered that there were few local farmers. There's only 4 days' worth of food in the grocery stores, and everything comes 1,500 miles via a just-in-time trucking system. I lost friends and family who told me I was crazy to worry about that, but I kept at it. I'm Marjorie Wildcraft. Those of us who know what's going on in the world know you need to become self-reliant before the dollar collapses. I've created a free webinar at gcnfood.com. I can show you, like I've shown hundreds of thousands of people, how to grow lots of food, even if you have no experience, you're older, or you're out of shape. Do it now, before the stores are boarded up and food is not available at any price. Go to gcnfood.com. gcnfood.com.
Did you receive a call or message that mentioned Social Security and demanded immediate action? Did the caller know your Social Security number or other personal information and tell you that your Social Security number had been used in connection with the crime? Did you feel worried that your Social Security number might be suspended, your bank account might be frozen or seized, or you could be arrested? That is not the Social Security Administration. Social Security will not threaten you, demand your personal information or instant payment, email or text you pictures or documents, or use a real government official's name to gain your trust. Social Security does not accept payments by gift card, prepaid debit card, internet currency, or by mailing cash. Criminals use these forms of payment because they are hard to trace. Do not be fooled. Hang up. Ignore them. Report this criminal activity to the Social Security Administration Office of the Inspector General at oig.ssa.gov.
Hi, this is Bryce Abel. I'm the producer of Dark Skies, the co-author of AD After Disclosure, and you are listening to the Paracast, the gold standard of paranormal radio.
So, Graham, it's kind of interesting about Captain Rupup because he was a mixed bag. At the end of the day, he, in his first edition of his book, The Report on Unidentified Flying Objects, indicated the pretty strong possibility of UFOs being real, possibly spaceships. Then he writes three new chapters. And in answer to the question whether he believes UFOs exist, he said, I'm positive they don't. The typical Air Force line. The thing that made it crazier is that he was friendly with Major Donald Keough, a pro-UFO advocate, a crime or fiction writer, and a writer on aviation. He wrote some very positive pro-UFO books. Now, when it came to Ruppelt, he said that the Air Force had put great pressure on Ruppelt to revise the book to make it more negative. That's one thing. Unfortunately, Ruppelt died at the age of 37 from a heart condition, and so he didn't stay around to answer those questions. So we just have the speculation.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Ruppelt, obviously, his association with UFO investigations actually predated, the formation of Blue Book in, was it March 1952? He'd also been involved with Grudge, or what he called New Grudge, I think, in towards the end of 1951. Grudge was basically, that was the one that came along after Project Sign, which was in 1948. And Project Sign was basically effectively strangled at birth because their estimate of the situation, if you like, when they tried to work out what was going on in terms of all these reports, they weren't sure. They didn't come down on heavily on, look, they're just weather balloons, they're Venus, all this kind of thing. They left the door open for a lot of things. And that was knocked down by senior US Air Force people because that wasn't what they wanted to hear. But also, they didn't have any evidence for it as well. So Grudge was then basically put in its place, if you like, to do the investigations, but with the kind of background of, we're going to have to work out what these are, and these are something we can explain, rather than, we don't know what these are. So it was almost like a flawed premise. And when Ruppelt came along, Grudge only had a couple of people, I think, working on it. It wasn't that big a program. And the filing was, I think, a bit chaotic. And they weren't keeping on top of a lot of the investigations anyway. And I think Ruppelt probably came along as maybe a new broom. And he had new ideas in terms of what they needed to do. He might not have been a kind of enthusiast or a believer, but he wasn't a skeptic either. I think he was somewhere in between, at least in the early days. And he was maybe just someone who genuinely wanted to find out what was going on. And he might have had ideas that the US Air Force might have come along and thought, well, okay, yes, you might be able to get somewhere with this and actually find out what they are, hoping they are something mundane and we can just like terminate this whole business and get it out of the way.
Is it fair to suggest that at least some of those early sightings that got lots of attention were, in fact, test aircraft, and the government possibly used the UFO or flying saucer connection to obscure that fact?
I think things were misidentified, and there'll be no doubt about that. And whether it was because they used the UFO sightings or not as cover, then you know it doesn't really matter one way or another. But you know, especially if you're looking at civilian people who are looking at mystery objects, they're not necessarily au fait with what you know certain types of aircraft look like, let alone experimental types. So no doubt people would see things that they didn't recognize, especially if they weren't used to seeing jet aircraft, let's say in 1946 or even in 1947 in certain parts of the country. And then, of course, if you jump forward a little bit, just take this conversation away from exactly what we're speaking about. If you jump forward into the 50s when they were starting to experiment with the U-2 spy plane, then, of course, the Air Force would have been quite happy for sightings of something very, very high altitude, which you can't make out too well, but looks silvery and it might shine a bit and look quite, you know, quite odd. They were quite happy to have those written off as UFO sightings because it obscured what they were really doing in this, you know, high-tech, high-altitude spy plane. But if you go back to the 1940s, then yes, undoubtedly some people were mistaking weather balloons, even Venus and other planets, stars, all the rest of it, for flying saucers, because it was effectively a bandwagon to a certain extent. People were genuinely seeing things they couldn't understand, but also there would be a lot of copycats as well looking for that 5 minutes of fame and fortune. Maybe they hoped, and certainly get their name in the papers. So yes, there'd be a bit of both. But that's probably happened throughout the next 7-8 decades, that people, you get genuine sightings, but you also get people who misidentify things, and you also get hoaxes, because there were some of those as well.
Going back to the what you were saying about Kenneth Arnold really setting off the whole media blitz when it came to UFOs. We know that people have been seeing things in the sky for quite a number of years. I mean, you have another whole book about the Foo Fighters during World War II. Before Kenneth Arnold, could it have been a possibility that people were seeing these things but weren't reporting it because of the war, that you're not going to go and possibly say something to the press that maybe some kind of wartime secret, and this involves both military and civilians as well?
The Foo Fighters, I mean, a lot of people just think that's a phenomenon that lasted from November 1944 across to the end of the war in Europe. But actually, the research I've done in terms of delving into, let's say, Royal Air Force records, it actually started a lot earlier. There's even reports, intelligence reports, from March 1940 of lights that followed bombers over Western Europe. So it goes a lot earlier, and they simply didn't know what they were back then. There was a lot of work done by bomber commands, intelligence departments, to try, this is obviously the British side I'm talking about, because this is even before the Americans entered the war, but they're trying to do a lot of work to work out what these lights are that are following aircraft. They can't identify what they are. They almost write them off as being just figments of imagination in some respects, but they are quite persistent. And in some cases, they follow aircraft for up to 250 miles. And obviously, that's no small thing. And they're not night fighters because they don't attack the bombers. They don't open fire at them. They're simply lights. And they can't work it out. And we know now that the Germans didn't experiment with airborne searchlights or anything like that. So it's not easy to simply explain these away as some kind of German secret technology. And they didn't have jet aircraft then. They didn't have rocket aircraft then in operation. Certainly didn't have the types of rockets that they had later, not just the V-2, but the flak rockets. So I wrote a book about this and actually brought out a whole load of sighting reports from the RAF much earlier in the war, and not just 1940, but 1941, 1942, and the mid-war years, and the stories of things that come up behind aircraft and the bombers open fire at them, and nothing happens. And they fly around to the front of the aircraft, and they open fire again, and nothing happens. Now, that's not German secret technology. That's something that you're way above that. But we still don't know what they were. And when these bomber pilots and these bomber crews landed back at base, and they reported this kind of thing to the intelligence officers in the debriefing, the reply was, have you been drinking? So there was almost a dismissive attitude by the people who should have been sitting at the take notice, even if it was just, well, this must be some kind of German technology, because actually that was the thrust of any kind of investigation. At the end of the war, they wrote it off as being jet fighters and flak rockets, neither of which were actually, you know, used earlier in the war.
Well, you know, the term, are you drinking, that complaint, that's been common over the years. Whenever somebody reports a UFO, what were you drinking? Of course, nowadays they say, what were you smoking? What kind of pills did you take? Because certainly I think with alcohol, you might get drunk, but you wouldn't imagine something flying in the sky and making pinpoint turns. I've never been drunk. I don't drink. I'm one of those rare people who has no clue about it.
But airline pilots, they can't. They have a bottle, you know, in military pilots, they have what they call a bottle to throttle rule. So, you know, they have a certain time that they're not allowed to drink between, you know, the last drink and when they fly. So it's very important that, you know, they're sober when they're say, flying an airliner full of hundreds of passengers, or they're flying a military aircraft with potential, you know, with live ammunition and bombs on board. And back in the war, you couldn't have pilots who were inebriated. You know, they couldn't carry out their missions. You had sobriety tests and all the rest of it. So you wouldn't last long in the skies over Europe as a fighter pilot or as a bomber pilot or a crew if you were drunk. It just didn't work. So, but that was, of course, somebody sitting on the ground who was a staff officer who, you know, their job was just to interrogate the crews when they came back to base. And the things they would normally ask them would be, have you seen any night fighters? You know, what was the flak like? Did you drop your bombs on time? All this kind of thing. And then, of course, when the pilot turns around with this huge, crazy story about strange lights coming up behind their aircraft, well, they've got no answer to that. And the question, it's a big laugh, and it's, oh, you know, have you been drinking? Do you need to lie down, old man? This kind of thing, you know? So there was a lot of that went on.
We've got Graham talking about vintage early UFO sightings and more with Gene and with Tim. You're in
the Pedicast.
You are listening to GCN. Visit GCNLive.com today.
Hey, listeners, I want you to have the entire Paracast experience, so I'd like to tell you about After the Paracast. After the Paracast is an exclusive feature for subscribers to the Paracast Plus. With After the Paracast, you never know what's going to happen next. After the Paracast features color commentary, special interviews, and further conversations with Paracast guests. With Paracast Plus, you can download a very special enhanced version of the Paracast also. We do offer exclusive music, videos, and more features are coming. To get more info about subscribing, please visit theparacast.plus. Once again, theparacast.plus. Prices are just $1.50 a week, less than a cup of coffee at your local convenience store. Check out theparacast.plus to learn more about Paracast Plus.
You ever get the feeling that the world is being held together with duct tape? Every day we're thrown some new meaningless drama in the fake news to distract us from the reality we're all about to face. Between the government trying to print their way out of debt, military conflicts, the disintegration of our most trusted institutions, and a looming food shortage, preparedness is no longer a choice. It's a necessity. You can trust My Patriot Supply. Our emergency food kits come packed with tasty meals, averaging over 2,000 calories per day. Get at least one kit for each person in your family. Self-reliance is the only alternative to government food lines. Time is running out. Become ungovernable. Go to MyPatriotSupply.com and save on dozens of different emergency food kits while you can. These kits are in stock, ship fast, and arrive in unmarked boxes for your privacy.
Go to MyPatriotSupply.com before the next crisis strikes. MyPatriotSupply.com.